Hey, I'm Bob Runkle, and for as long as I can remember, I've loved pop culture. Despite the challenges I've faced in my life, pop culture has always been there for me. I love talking to people and being a platform for others to share their thoughts, stories. Because if there's one thing I never get tired of, it's seeing driven, talented, and inspiring individuals follow their dreams, no matter what obstacles are in their way. And I know a thing or two about that. Welcome to the DJ Bob Show. I'm DJ Bob. Roll it. I'm so excited to welcome Harvey Brownstone, former judge and host of the brilliant entertainment talk show, Harvey Brownstone Interviews. I talk with Harvey about starting the show, overcoming adversity, and so much more. We share our love of the Rosie O'Donnell Show and just have a wonderful conversation. I hope you enjoy. Harvey, first of all, thank you so much for coming on our show and, you know, being a new listener to this podcast after your invitation. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So to start our conversation off, could you kind of give us a little bit of an elevator pitch of who you are and what you've done, because you've done a lot, and it's a really inspiring story, and it's a very important story that needs to be shared.
Well, my name is Harvey Brownstone. I was the first openly gay judge appointed in Canada. That began my profile as a public figure. While I was a judge, I wrote a best-selling book called Tug of War, which was the first book written by a sitting judge telling the public what family court was really all about and what they needed to know before going there, because I found that people really didn't know. And I also had a television show as a judge called Family Matters with Justice Harvey Brownstone. So I became very, very well known because of those two things, the book and the show. And then I retired after 26 years of being a judge, and I decided to launch my own talk show online on a YouTube channel called Harvey Brownstone Interviews. Although I have interviewed a few lawyers, my show really focuses on Hollywood stars and Broadway stars and authors. And we've now been in operation 3 years. We are televised in the UK on the XPTV1 network. We have 2.7 million viewers a week watching us. We're on twice a week in the UK. And in the rest of the world, we are found on our YouTube channel, Harvey Brownstone Interviews, and on the website, Harvey Brownstone Interviews. And we have just over 5 million viewers a month watching our show. So that's the quick and dirty.
Nice. So what was the biggest learning curve for you when starting a podcast? Like, what was your first steps to making this happen?
Well, I wanted to see if I could get anybody famous to talk to me. You know, I'm a baby boomer. I grew up idolizing a lot of singers and TV stars and movie stars. And my biggest challenge was not having any show business experience, no connections in Hollywood, seeing if I could get anybody famous to come on the show. And it was difficult, for sure. I think the fact that I had been a judge made me something of a curiosity. And after a few months, I finally started to get some celebrities. And that really took off, because the way I interview people is rather unique. I am extremely well-researched, and I ask questions that they've never been asked before. And so the celebrities themselves began to see that I was doing something that really no one else was doing. And they started sending me their friends. And before you know it, we started getting a lot of agents and managers and publicists in Hollywood and New York asking if their clients could come on the show because they could see that we were getting big numbers and we were getting, and their clients were getting very good interviews. So that, in a nutshell, that's how we started.
Yeah, that's the common ground that you and I have. It's like, we try to ask the questions that not only is the person we're interviewing not asked, but generally, some people don't care about the questions we ask. Like, they don't think like we think.
Well, I find that most celebrities who have been around a very long time are tired of the same old questions that they get asked about their landmark movies and TV shows. And so they go on automatic pilot. But I make a point very early on in the interview to let them know that I've done my homework. I know their career inside out, and this is not going to be a boilerplate interview. And now I don't have to do that anymore because I have a reputation. They know I'm well known. When I first started, nobody knew who I was, and these celebrities would, you know, be pretty abrupt. But now they all know. They know who I am. They know what my show's all about. Most of them have seen it. They know to expect that this is going to be an interview unlike any other. And I'm very proud of that because that's what my viewers want. That's how you build an audience. There are millions of podcasts out there, as you know, Bob, and the only way to distinguish yourself and to really build an audience and create some kind of a future out of it is if you do something no one else does.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know if you know this, but I started doing this show when I was 15 years old. I'm 28 now. And when I started, people in the entertainment industry didn't give me the time of day because of how young I was. But after a while, I had to prove them. I had to sort of prove them wrong and kind of realize, no, I do the prep. I do the research. I do care about whoever I'm talking to.
Well, that really shows. And, you know, you are an amazing person. You have been doing this so long. We actually had a 15-year-old podcaster on our show a few months ago.
I heard that. Yeah, I watched that one. That was so fascinating.
He is a genius in my books. His name is Charles Kirsch. I'm just in awe of this young boy because the knowledge, the poise, the judgment, the intelligence that this young man has is off the charts. And you were another one that started really young. You were one of the pioneers. When you were 15, there were not a lot of podcasts out there, and you started something new. And I applaud you for that. It's really an honor to be on your show.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you because from the moment I started watching your podcast, because one of the pivotal television shows for me when I was younger was the Rosie O'Donnell Show. So I saw John's interview first. That was my introduction to you. And just from your intro to the guest, to the thorough research that flips them on their head, that throws them off, and they're like, how do you know that? It's like, that's what I do.
Yes, it is. It is. And we're kindred spirits. You know, I absolutely was addicted to the Rosie O'Donnell Show when it was on. I loved her. I felt I knew her. I felt she was my best friend. I'm still heartbroken that I have not had her on the show. She's just not easy to reach.
Shame.
Yeah, she's just not, no matter how many times I've tried through people who know her well, it has not happened yet, but I remain hopeful that one day I'll have her on. Although, I have to say,
maybe we can tag team and maybe we could do it together. Who knows?
Yeah, you never know. I will say, though, that it's become very clear to me that Rosie O'Donnell is not the same person as she was on the Rosie O'Donnell show. That was very much a screen persona. It was nothing like who she is. And that, frankly, is a little bit of a disappointment because I don't think she's funny anymore. I think she's become very, very serious.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of my past guests had an experience with her where they were on the show and they were kind of disappointed by the reaction, and it kind of ruined their view on her forever.
Yeah, that can happen. I hope that it won't happen with you and me when our viewers and listeners meet us. But I have to say that I have heard that many times. But, you know, in her defense, she got trapped into this label of being the Queen of Nice, and it worked for her talk show. And she was in the closet at the time and had to, you know, toe the company line because of her popularity. She couldn't come out of the closet. She had to maintain this persona that was really very appealing, very likable. And she just had to submerge, you know, the very serious part of her. Although as the show progressed, she got more serious. And certainly after 9/11, we saw a big change in the way she presented herself. So, you know, maybe one day we'll get her on our show.
We talk about the age. We talk about you being a boomer, me being a millennial. That show was the perfect bridging the gap because you would have, I don't know, Elmo on from Sesame Street, and then you'd have a cast of a Broadway show. It was just so, it was so reminiscent of like variety shows, and it really hasn't happened since.
No, it hasn't. I don't think that Ellen, who really took over, I don't think Ellen did it. I don't think anyone else did it the way Rosie did. She was reminiscent of Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin and the variety show talk show hosts. I very much would love to do that myself. It's my dream to do something like that. You know, Zoom is great, but it's very frustrating. And there's limitations. But, you know, my definite long-term goal would be to do what Rosie was doing.
Well, something that I want to tell you and commend you for is that your show is very comfortable. It's comforting. And
that's a lovely thing to say. I what do you mean? In what way is it comforting? I've never heard that before.
There are some days where prepping, you know, leading up to this interview, I was just binge watching interviews and really immersing myself in the Harvey Brownstone universe. And I watch your episode and I just feel like he's talking to me and only me, and everything's going to be okay for however long it is. You put everyone at ease, even the viewer. And it's so comforting to me. And it's appointment watching for me now.
Well, Bob, you've given me goosebumps. You actually you made me teary-eyed because that's always been my hope. And although I do get very nice comments on, you know, Facebook and YouTube and submitted on our website, I've never had someone say it quite like you did. And it means the world to me, Bob. Thank you. I put my heart and soul into that show, into every single interview. And getting a comment like that from someone who's been doing this so much longer, has so much more expertise than me, is a huge honor. And I'm very deeply touched and very grateful.
And here's one of the other common grounds that we have. One of my first interviews when I started doing this podcast, because it started out as a live show, and then it transitioned into podcasting. But one of my first interviews that from when we transitioned was Billy Gilman.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Billy.
And it's interesting because it was before he came out. a couple months before that, I could hear it in his voice that he wasn't. He was talking to me. We were having a lighthearted chat, but you know how you can tell something going on just by their voice or their tone?
Yeah.
You could hear that he was hiding something. So when he did that, I was like, you know what? I felt a sigh of relief for him.
Yeah. I think he's so talented. I love his voice. I think he should have won The Voice. And I don't understand why he hasn't had a bigger career. I really don't understand it. He's a lovely, lovely guy. And I'm glad he was able to come out. I think that as a child, he was heads and shoulders above any other child singer I've ever heard. So that was fun having him on the show. I was a little disappointed, though, I'll tell you. There was a song written about my story by Harriet Schock, who is a multi-platinum Grammy-nominated songwriter. She wrote a song called I Am Yours, which is out there now. And it's about my struggle to get parental acceptance after coming out. And I sent the song to Billy because I really thought he should record it. And I never got a response. And that is something I have learned. I don't know if you've had that experience, but when they're on the show, they act like they're your best friends. But once the show is over, the vast majority are not reachable again. That's just the way it is. I have made some very good friendships. Robert Wagner, Tony Orlando, and a number of others have remained very good friends, and I'm in touch regularly. But the vast majority, and Billy Gilman is in that category, you know, he didn't even respond to my email. I was actually quite disappointed because I think the song would have been great for Kim, and it would have been great for the community too, but I have not ever received a response.
But it's just so funny that even though, you know, we are covering kind of different areas of pop culture, that we still have this common ground of like just researching to no end and giving these folks an interview that they'll hopefully never forget. I mean, you made Tony Orlando cry.
Well, you really did watch, didn't you? Well, that was probably the most memorable interview we've done so far. I have to say that when he cried, I was so taken off guard because I asked him a question that I've asked many other guests, which is, it's a very typical Harvey Brownstone-ism to ramble off a number of special moments in their lives and then ask them, do you have to pinch yourself at the life you've led? And never have I had a reaction like that. Tony, really, we had to stop the interview. He needed to compose himself. And then we started filming again. That's the beauty of having a show that is edited.
It really clicked with him. I think it really just sunk in.
Yeah, he was just not used to being treated like a real star and a serious musician. And I wasn't prepared that my approach would touch him so profoundly. Anyway, it created a beautiful friendship. I was inundated. Both he and I were inundated with hundreds of thousands of messages from people asking to please have him come back. They wanted more. So 3 weeks later, he did come back to the show and we had a lovely conversation again.
Yeah. That episode is among one of my favorites. He's someone that I've always wanted to get on my podcast too, because I've always found him so fascinating, and you know, the music and all that stuff. So like, just hearing the vulnerability in your content is so important. And I'm gonna make an assumption here, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but you and I are not here for the soundbite interview.
No. Definitely not. Most definitely not. You know, we are here for an interview that will give the audience a real sense of who the person is. You know, behind the curtain, underneath the celebrity veneer, who are they? What matters to them? How did they get where they got? What makes them tick? What's in their heart? You know, and that's my specialty. That's what I did as a judge. When I had people in my courtroom, I tried to find out who they really were so I could really communicate and make a difference in their lives. And that's what I try to do as an interviewer. And very few people do it. I'm actually shocked at how many podcasts there are out there that are so amateurish. I don't understand how these people ever get an audience, because it's just very, very amateurish, unprofessional.
Story of my life, man. I can't. There's so many podcasts that just, like, I hear it, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, it's actually really surprising.
The thing I always say is, just because you can, doesn't mean.
Right, right. I'm afraid so. I don't know. You know, I have appeared on many podcasts because I always say yes. I feel that it's so hard to get guests, and my heart goes out to anybody who's trying to establish a show. And I know how that was when I started. So I always want to be there for people. So I never say no. But I must tell you, Bob, some of the interview shows I've been on were just an embarrassment. There was just, you could tell they had no preparation. They didn't ask one interesting thing. They knew nothing about me or my show. And I felt like I was interviewing myself.
Well, I hope you're not feeling that way right now. And
well, no. And I have to tell you, you are a real pro. You've been doing this a long time. You have proven yourself over and over again to be a real pro. And I'm sure that's why you have the audience you have. You are a pleasure to listen to. You're insightful. You're intelligent. You do care.
And, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I don't know. I mean, we've just met today, but I feel like we've known each other for longer than we, you know what I'm saying? Like, it just feels right.
Well, that's so sweet. I feel the same way. I feel like I made a new friend today.
My question for you is this, and this is something that you kind of alluded to, but I'm going to expand on it here. So you talked about your struggles when you were 19 years old, coming out, all those things. What would you tell 19-year-old you?
Well, to be honest, I would have said, don't come out. I don't think it's a good idea to come out to your parents when you're financially dependent on them, because in my case, it created a catastrophe in my life. So unless you're very sure that your parents are going to be supportive and you're still going to be able to afford to live the way you were living before, don't tell them. So that's the first thing I would have said to my 19-year-old me. And the second thing I would have said is to be confident in following my own instincts. Because in my life, I have been very fortunate that that has been true. I have followed my instincts, my guts, whether it was a job or a relationship or any opportunities. I listened to my intuition about whether this was right for me. And it always was. So I would have reinforced to myself to don't be afraid to listen to what that little voice inside you is saying, because it will be right. You know, everybody thought I was crazy to retire from the judiciary. Most judges in Canada work until they're 75. You are allowed to remain a judge until you're 75. And I got the job at 38. So when I was 65, I was already a judge 26 years, and I felt that I'd had enough. I had sent enough people to jail. I had dealt with enough tragedy. And everyone said to me, you're out of your mind. Why would you leave this very prestigious job? It pays very well, to go and be a podcaster. Like, you must be out of your mind. But my gut told me that that was the time to do it. The pandemic was on, and I knew that all these stars were available. They were not working. So I knew that if I followed my instincts, I needed to pursue that because I was sure that eventually I would be a success. Now, did I know we would get, you know, there would be a line of coffee named after me and that we would be on television and that we would have quite the level of celebrities we're getting? No, to be honest, no. But I did have a feeling that if I did this, and if I did it really well, I would have some success.
And you really have achieved that. And it's an interesting story that I would like to share with you. When I was about 2 years in to this podcast, I was 17 years old, and I landed an interview with a pretty well-known rock band from the 90s, Smash Mouth. And I wanted to interview the lead singer, and I was really struggling. The equipment wasn't working. The gear was just not in my favor that day. So I call him up. I say, can you give me 5 more minutes? I just need time to reset, right? And he goes, I don't have time for this, retard. And then hangs up on me.
Oh my God, I'm stunned. Really, really shocked. I have to say, I haven't had that happen to me. I haven't had anybody be rude. I've had one. There was one musician that was rude and he didn't want a long introduction. He didn't like that I was going into his history. He said, oh, that's all ancient history. Move on, move on. And I said, wait a minute. You're a guest on my show. I am known for my introductions. It's one of my hallmarks.
I love your introduction.
Thank you. Anyway, I'm proud of myself because I was successful enough that I had the guts to say, wait a minute, this is how we're doing it. And if you don't like it, then don't do my show. I don't need you. And he calmed right down and he said, okay, go ahead. And we started the intro again and he let me finish it. And he actually turned out to be very engaging, very warm. But that's the only time I've had anybody be rude. Otherwise, really, even through all the technical glitches that I know you're very familiar with, as am I haven't had anybody be rude. In fact, I'm amazed at how nice these Hollywood stars are. In fact, the bigger, the more talented and the more famous and the bigger they are, the nicer they are.
That's pretty true. I mean, I've been invited to several, you know, movie press junkets or whatever. And the nicer the celebrity, the more they want to talk. And with those junkets, you're on a 10-minute time limit. They want to keep going, but you can't. And that's a testament to what they don't get in interviews, and they want more of it.
Yeah. See, I won't do those junkets. If they won't give me at least 30 minutes, I'm not interested because my show has a certain format, my audience. You know, you can't be all things to all people, but I have identified an audience that likes what I do the way I do it. And so that's how we do it. So when I have guests that don't want to come on my show unless it's audio, I say no. We are a video show. If they're not going to let us see them, then we're not doing it. And if I have guests that say, well, I've only got 10 minutes. No, that's not what this show is.
I'm going to tell you this. If I ever come on your show, I will go on video for you.
Thank you, Bob.
I will make an appearance. It would be a fun time, I think. Yes, I am inviting myself on your show.
That would be lovely. And yes, we would want to see you. You're a very handsome guy, a very engaging young man, and I think the world needs to see you.
I love that. So we're both fans of talk shows, and I love when talk shows have guest hosts, when they have guest hosts, you know, take over. Which one of your guests would you want to take over your show?
Well, that's a really good question because we've never, ever considered having a guest host. I think Ruta Lee would be a wonderful guest host. She's really a such an engaging, warm person. I would love Lucy Arnaz to do it. I think she'd be really great. Tony Orlando would probably be, you know, he has a already.
That was my answer. That was what I was going to recommend to you. That'd be great.
Yeah, he has a radio show every Saturday night, so he does know how to do interviews. He's very good at it. He would be great. But you know what? I don't think that's ever going to happen. I have been approached by numerous people to do a co-hosting thing because there are many podcasts that have co-hosts. It's not what I do.
That used to be me. I used to have three different co-hosts, and I was like, hello, I'm not... This isn't benefiting me.
Yeah. Yeah, I admire the ones that do it. I just don't think it's what I do. I'm too used to working alone. I worked alone as a judge, you know, I ran my own show as a judge. And when I was a lawyer, you know, I worked alone. I didn't have some other lawyer beside me asking questions. I did it. And so I just don't need a co-host. And I guess I like being the one in charge and doing things my way. So, but having a substitute host, you know, that would be kind of fun, I guess. That's something to think about.
You know how you manifest things on your show? I'm doing it. I'm doing it for you. You say, I want this musical to happen. I want this album to happen. I'm doing this for you right now.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want the credit.
Thank you, Bob. I'll give you the credit. If we get a co-host, not a co-host, a substitute host, I'll definitely give you the credit.
I would love that. So we've been having this conversation, and I've been so inspired by your story and us sharing stories. So my question for you is, well, do you have any questions for me about what I do or just anything? Let's talk a little bit. What do you want to know?
Well, I'd like to know how you decide who you want to interview.
It's a mixed bag. Some people, I'm just so... Sometimes I see something on YouTube or Instagram or Facebook, and I'm just so, like, enamored by what they do, and I want to be connected with them, like you. I tracked you down after being like, I need to talk to this guy. Because you're like me. Exactly. And we have the genuine level of care. But other times, I try to focus on things that matter to me or matter to me. As a young kid, I'll interview my ninth grade history teacher and get her insight about how I was as a student. So it's because as a kid, my life was not sheltered, but I was so limited. Pop culture and all that stuff meant more to me than the average kid. Because when you're going through struggles, you rely on things that are right there, that you can go home to, that you can watch, that you can listen to, that you can read, that you can enjoy, to just feel good, comfortable. You can relate to them in a way, yeah, even just for a little bit. You're in their world and you're away from yours.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. You're absolutely right. That's why I was such a Lucy fan when I was growing up, because I was so badly bullied as a kid that I would come home from school and Lucy was on at 4:30 in the afternoon, and I just escaped into the I Love Lucy show and forgot all my troubles. Pop culture absolutely does that for you. Well, another question I have for you is, how have you grown your audience? What do you do to grow your audience?
I try to interview different types of people because for the longest time, I was pigeonholed as like this children's television aficionado. And that'll always be a part of me because I started interviewing people from Jim Henson Productions and people like that. But then
I really wanted to talk to people that other audiences would be into as well. So I just, and I really try to engage with them and be open on social media and also be vulnerable like this. Because once they have a way in to your heart and to how you feel, you're not putting on a facade, so you're giving them more of the reason to connect with you.
Well, I think that's a very legitimate way to grow your audience. You have a wide variety of guests, and you rely on their followers to discover you because they want to see the person they're following, and then they become hooked on you. And I admire you very much. I think it's really wonderful. What do you see yourself? What's the ultimate goal for the DJ Bob show?
The ultimate goal is this: to show people that people with disabilities can still create, can still have viable content that people can enjoy, that it's not thrown together, that it's not forced, that it's not thrown in people's faces. When I started this podcast in high school, people would say to me, "Who set this up for you? What organization set it up for you?" Like, I did. You know what I'm saying? Like, people thought that it was like a make-a-wish thing.
Right.
And it's like, what, we can't create?
But you've already achieved all of that. You have proven all of that over the years. What's the next level? Where do you want to take it?
One of the things that I'm working on now is I'm writing a book.
Oh, that's really exciting.
I'm writing a young adult novel about a young teenager with a disability who is a pop culture obsessed nerd, essentially. And because when I was in that age bracket, they need the most attention because they're the most vulnerable of that age group. So I just want to create a story that I would have read.
That's beautiful, Bob. Well, I wish you the best of luck with that. And when the book is out, please do come on our show to promote it.
I'd be happy to. I really feel so empowered by your work and what you do. And I have a couple more questions for you before we wrap up. When you were a judge, what was your experience of those with disabilities?
Well, that's a good question, because when I was in family court, I didn't see a lot of people with disabilities in the traditional sense. In criminal court, the vast majority of people that I dealt with had fetal alcohol syndrome. That was the number one disability. People who had developmental delays because of fetal alcohol syndrome, or they were born addicted to cocaine because their mother had been taking drugs during the pregnancy. We saw a lot of that. I did not see a lot of people with defined illnesses like MS or cerebral palsy or something like that. I didn't see them. I don't think the court system deals very well with many issues, and I think that would be one of them that I would throw in. I don't think that the justice system does very well with people who have challenges that make life harder for them and sometimes gives them cause to behave inappropriate and get themselves in trouble, you know?
One of my favorite interviews I've ever done, and if you haven't gotten him on your show, which I don't think you have, you should. It's David Archuleta.
Oh, yes. I've reached out to him and got no reply.
He's a fantastic guest. We had 30 minutes with him, and we had such a deep conversation about diversity and inclusion and him, you know, coming out. It was a conversation that people weren't expecting, but it turned out to be one of my favorite ones because of how vulnerable it was.
Oh boy, I'm going to, as soon as we hang up, I'm going to go and listen to that one because I really like him. I wanted him to win American Idol.
Me too. I remember him on Star Search when they brought it back.
Well, I don't understand why he hasn't had a much bigger career.
Yeah, I don't either. I really don't either.
Well, I think that you are definitely on the right track to achieving all of the goals that you mentioned.
Recently, I've been dealing with the whole concept of imposter syndrome.
Do you have imposter syndrome?
I think that I do sometimes.
Well, I think that if you've been doing your show for as long as you have and you've had the success you've had, what part of your delivery as a talk show host, interviewer, do you think isn't legit, that is impostering?
Sometimes I feel like I'm a waste of people's time when people don't respond to me. I think it's my fault.
I don't think that's imposter syndrome. That's different. That's not that you don't really believe that you're as good as you are. I think that's the kind of rejection we all fear, you know? And the thing about maybe being a waste of time is that people, that's their decision. That's up to them to decide if they want to listen to your show and how long they want to listen. Do they want to listen to the whole thing or just the first few minutes? That isn't your call. It's not something you're ever going to really know. So I don't think that's worth focusing on. And when you don't get the response you're hoping to get, I don't see that as an imposter syndrome. I just see that as being disappointed with expectations you have that don't get fulfilled. And you're in show business. And in show business, that is par for the course. Rejection is so common. You know, even now, if I were to write to 10 A-list stars, I'm talking Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, Tom Hanks, people like that, probably all 10 would say no, you know, but there might be one that says yes.
It's to the point where sometimes I will feel this so much that I sit and wait and don't send emails out or call people because I get so in my head about everything.
Well, that is because you're a sensitive person who really cares about your show and you have hopes and dreams and aspirations for the show and you get disappointed. And I relate to all of that you're saying. I relate to it. Even though it's easier now than it was 2 years ago to get a guest, it's still hard. There are still people that, you know, like I told you, Rosie O'Donnell, we've never gotten through to her. I never got an answer from David Archuleta's people. I think I went on his website and wrote a comment asking to be contacted. I think you just have to believe in yourself that you are worthy of success and that if they don't respond to your invitation, that's their loss. It is their loss, not yours.
And I've bounced back from it, but it is just kind of like when you're in that mode for a long time, like it's kind of hard to get out of it.
Well, when you're doing your show, it's important that you keep the conversation on topics that you think your listeners want to hear about, you know? So if you want to be compelling and you want to be popular, you've got to craft your interviews in such a way that you're talking about interesting things, interesting aspects of your guest's life, interesting issues that matter to them. That's how you generate interest.
So as we wrap up, we were talking a bit before about, you know, what you thought about the show and what you liked about it. But I want to just tell you what really struck me about your podcast and what I really connected to. Just so it's not an ego boost. I just want you to know how much your podcast sort of informs. You taught me a lot of things, Harvey. That's what I'm saying.
That's very touching because I don't feel that I'm in a position to teach anybody anything about this. I'm just too new at it. So I just can't even tell you how kind that is of you.
One of the things that I really gravitated toward with your podcast is you're not afraid to ask them a question that others just wouldn't ask,
right?
Because of the way it's worded, or so. And it's like the way you lead into things and the way you lead out is just so commendable, because so many people are like, so how did you get started? I hate that. That's why the elevator pitch, or the way you start off your stuff, works specifically tailored to the guest, is way more effective.
Well, I appreciate that. I have to say, I have never started my show by asking the guest to describe themselves, because I want them to see that I did my homework and that I already know their whole career. And once they see that, I find that they are willing to answer questions that maybe other people wouldn't have the guts to ask. But most of the time, they're surprised that I knew, that I was able to ask questions about things that no one else knew about. And that's just from doing research. You know, everything from Wikipedia to websites to listening to their other interviews, watching their movies and their shows, watching interviews with people that they've worked with. It's very time consuming. It takes a lot of effort. But it does pay off, because there is an audience out there that wants that. You know, not everybody has the patience for some of my interviews go an hour, and not everybody wants to sit that long, and they don't have the patience. But there is an audience that does like that. I've proven that. And those are the people I cater to, who really want, they don't want the entertainment tonight 30-second soundbite. They want a real interview, and they get that. So it takes a lot of work. And I'm very grateful that you pick up on it. It means the world to me, because it means you see what I'm doing, and that makes it worthwhile. It makes all that work worthwhile. So I really appreciate it. And if I've taught you anything, I think what I would like to be the person to teach you is to keep believing in yourself. Don't let anybody make you doubt what you're doing, the value of what you're doing, the importance of it, and the necessity of it. You know, just don't ever surrender that power to anybody. If somebody doesn't respond to an invitation, that's their loss. And if they do respond and they say no, that's also their loss. One day they won't. I've had people say no, and then a year later, they're contacting me asking if they can come on the show. That's the best revenge. Is success.
You've also taught me a lot about old Hollywood. There are some names that I would have never even looked into, but I'm learning so much.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. I love old Hollywood, the golden era. And I'm glad that I've had the privilege of interviewing the children of many old stars like Errol Flynn and Hedy Lamarr and Lucy and Dean Martin and Boris Karloff, you know, Peggy Lee.
I love the Don Knotts.
The Don Knotts one, and the Tim Conway. You know, these people are no longer with us, but through their children, we just had, as a matter of fact, the son of Audrey Hepburn, one of the greatest Hollywood stars of all time.
I know. That was like, wow.
You know, that took a long time. It was very... He's a very busy guy. He doesn't give interviews a lot. And this was a real privilege. It was like talking to Hollywood royalty. I was in awe.
So my final question for you is this. This is a heavy one. Let's say that YouTube is no longer. Podcast feeds are wiped out from the internet. And if you were to put one episode of your podcast in a time capsule for people to remember your show, which one?
Well, that's really hard. You know, my favorite episode is the Tony Orlando one. But if I were to really show which interview I feel that I really knocked it out of the park, it would probably be the one with Lucille Ball's best friend, the Lee Tannen, who wrote a book called I Loved Lucy. It was his best friend. That interview was my first, one of my very first ones, and I really loved it because he started out being quite mistrusting of me and not quite sure what to make of me. And within about 10 minutes, he was fawning over me and telling me how great I was. And I loved that I won him over in real time in front of an audience. I could tell I was winning him over. That interview really, more than any other, demonstrates my particular gift, that I can take somebody who doesn't know anything about me and isn't that willing to open up and get them to open up. So if it weren't that one, it would probably be Robert Wagner. That was a very special one to me. He doesn't do interviews. He was 92 at the time. He really is very reluctant to do any kind of interviewing. And it took me a long time to make that happen. I was very proud of how that one went. So it would either be the Lee Tannen one or the Robert Wagner one.
The one that sticks out to me, and one that I would put in there as an honorable mention, at least for what I think encapsulates the kind of vulnerability of the show too, is John Edward.
John Edward, also, yeah, John Edward for sure. And also Paul Williams. Paul Williams, the music, the songwriter who told me that I was more valuable to him than his therapist when he said that. That really threw me. I wasn't prepared that what I was saying to him about his personality was digging so deep that he actually said, you know, Harvey, I want to write you a check. You've done more for me than my therapist. That really mattered a lot.
This conversation has been so vulnerable and so real. And I mean, like we said, I made a new friend today.
You sure did, Bob. So did I.
So where can people find your stuff? Where can people find your content?
Well, if they go to YouTube, just go to Harvey Brownstone Interviews, and there's a channel there, and click on videos, and there's 350 shows there. If they go to the internet, they can go to the website, harveybrownstoneinterviews.com, and you can see all the shows on the website. And of course, if you're in the United Kingdom, we are on XPTV1 every Wednesday and Friday. And of course, if they want the audio, if they just want audio, we are on every single audio platform.
Yeah, you're everywhere. You're everywhere, man. You're everywhere. I will say this. I don't have any koosh balls to supply you, bringing it back to how it started with our Rosie talk. But this conversation has been a delight. And I would really love to keep in touch with you if you're up to that.
I would be delighted, Bob. I'm so grateful you had me on the show. And you did send me a koosh ball, an emotional hug and a koosh ball that went right into my heart. I so appreciate who you are, what you've achieved, the way you live your life, the fact that you've let nothing define you except your own personality and your hopes and dreams, your intelligence, your sense of humor, your warmth. You are someone to look up to, and I am a friend and a fan.
Well, this has been a brilliant conversation. Check out Harvey's content, because you will be enamored and obsessed, and it's addicting. And check it out. I really hope you all have loved this conversation as much as I have. Thanks for joining me, Harvey.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks for hanging out with us at the DJ Bob Show. If you liked this episode, drop us a line at djbobrunkel@gmail.com. That's djbobrunkel@gmail.com. Let us know what you liked most about this episode and what other guests we should have on the DJ Bob Show. Thanks so much again for hanging out with us. This is Nate Beagle, your humble announcer.